This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Selvaraj. Now, steroid injections have become a commonly accepted form of treatment for knee or hip pain caused by osteoarthritis. But a new study by the Boston University School of Medicine reveals that these steroid injections may be, and we're emphasizing on may be, harmful in certain groups of patients or may cause complications that are not well understood. And here to help us understand is consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh. Now, as always, if you have questions for us, please do call us at 0377 332 900. You can WhatsApp us at 018 789 8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We'd be happy to take your questions on the topic of, are steroid injections for osteoarthritis unsafe? Hi, Dr. Rajesh.
Hi, Sumitra.
So, first off, we're going to be talking about steroids, which is a bit of a scary word for a lot of people. Yeah. Perhaps you can outline for us in this context what we mean by steroids.
Okay, so the common misunderstanding when you talk about steroids is people think about bodybuilding steroids. So when sort of bodybuilders use steroids, there are a class of steroid called anabolic steroids. So usually in men, that's testosterone. What we're talking about in this context is a hormone that is normally produced by a gland in the body called the adrenal gland. And that produces a hormone called cortisol. That's a stress hormone. The stress hormone has certain predictable actions on the body. And one of those actions includes suppression of inflammation, which is basically an immune-driven event.
Okay.
So what we're talking about in this event is a molecule which your body would produce normally.
Okay.
Is now synthesized in a lab, and so we have it in a form that can be given to patients.
So we have a base amount of steroids
running around the system. And when people realize that, they sort of go, oh, okay, so hang on, so you mean steroids are organic? Well, they are. We produce steroids.
Right.
They're also natural. We produce steroids. But used wrongly, they're unsafe. Okay, and I think a lot of the confusion around the topic sort of stems from the fact that the term steroid used here doesn't refer to just the one formulation or compound, right? So there's probably about half a dozen types of steroids, steroid compounds that can be used into injections of joints. The second sort of variable here is which patients are getting it and for what reason. And I think that's probably part of the reason why the field is so unclear, because you're not clearly defining what you're giving, how you're giving it, why you're giving it, and in whom you're giving it. So papers like this, I think, are a little bit of an alarmist kind of perspective. You know, it certainly gets some good headlines. But if the aim of the paper was just to raise a little bit of awareness that steroids shouldn't be used blindly, then, you know, I think that's great. But if the aim of the paper is to sort of generate clickbait, then I think that the sort of public's being misled in terms of where the paper's taking us.
Which is why we have you in the studio today. You mentioned that there are, of course, various uses for steroids. Today, we're going to be looking at steroid injections for osteoarthritis. But perhaps before we get into that, just a quick kind of refresher on some of the different uses of steroids.
Okay. So the corticosteroids, which is the sort of drugs that we're talking about, are used to suppress inflammation anywhere in the body.
Okay.
So people who have a skin condition which causes red, dry, scaly skin, they'll have a steroid application. People who have diseases, inflammatory diseases of the bowel, like ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, they'll actually have a rectal steroid foam.
Okay.
So, you know, like shaving cream, sort of stick it up their bum and foam steroid goes into the rectum and actually suppresses inflammation.
Okay.
It's also given by mouth. So people who have asthma, for example, they're given steroid tablets to suppress inflammation. People who have infections of various varieties, like a viral infection, for example, they get steroids as well.
And I understand it's used in autoimmune conditions as well.
Correct. But it's used in autoimmune conditions to suppress inflammation.
Right.
So one of the sort of big ideas that I want to get out is this term inflammation. So inflammation, right? So what is inflammation? So a simple analogy is if you get sand in your eye becomes red and painful. Now, that process of your eye becoming red and painful is inflammation. And in this case, the insult that caused the inflammation is the sand that rubbed against your eye caused a mechanical injury. Now, steroids are very good at suppressing inflammation, right? So let's go back one step. Inflammation is the final common pathway for almost all musculoskeletal injury.
Okay.
Which includes cumulative micro injury that results in what we commonly term osteoarthritis, be it of the hip or knee. So chronic untreated inflammation causes complications. Chronic inflammation is painful. Mm. Complications of chronic untreated inflammation are also painful and restrictive. Mm. Thus, if you have an anti-inflammatory, then you have the ability to suppress inflammation. And once you suppress inflammation, you give the body an opportunity to heal. Mm. So the analogy that I always use is inflammation is like a small fire. Now, in a house, you use fire all the time. You use fire in the kitchen to cook stuff. You use fire on mosquito coils when you want to sort of, you know, light a mosquito coil somewhere. You use a vape mat, like one of those electric vape mats that gets hot again for your mosquito repellents. There's lots of, you know, you use a hairdryer, that's fire. Again, use a water heater, that's fire again. So fire used correctly in a household is very constructive.
Yes.
But if any of those items catch on fire, they inflames, well, that's very destructive. Mm-hmm. And that's a simple way to understand where things go wrong in the skeletal system. Mm. Because any injury which is chronically untreated in the skeletal system will give you the final common pathway of inflammation, which is why historically steroids have been so widely used in inflammation. Because the steroids are literally like a fire extinguisher, right? So let's say somebody presents with acute gout. So that means that they say, my knee is red, hot, angry, swollen. It's swollen up like a football. It's excruciatingly painful. I can't walk. I can't sleep. I can't eat. I can't even breathe. If I stick a needle in there, suck away the fluid and give them some steroid, the pain disappears like magic. Mm-hmm. Because all I've done is I've suppressed the inflammation.
Right.
But the cause of that inflammation, the root cause of that inflammation is the person's gout. Mm-hmm. So if you don't treat the gout, then all you've done is you've just extinguished the fire and tomorrow somebody's going to come and poke new fire again.
So I want to take that analogy one step further just for a little bit of clarity. So do steroids then contain the fire or do they extinguish the
fire? They extinguish the fire.
Okay.
Right? They extinguish the fire for a period of time until somebody comes and pokes fire again.
Right.
Right? And that's the problem. So the problem with sort of the historic use of steroids has, well, the reason why we're having this topic is basically because it's a swing of the pendulum more to the middle. Because the pendulum has swung to the right where people have said steroids are the best thing since sliced bread for joint pains. Well, I mean, they were, but you have to understand the context in which that came about. The idea sort of with, again, all the final common pathway for all musculoskeletal terminal events, if you want to call them that, injury, is inflammation.
Okay.
If you suppress inflammation, it allows the body to regenerate and to heal, right? So if you combine suppression of inflammation with proper physiotherapy or rehabilitative treatment, rest, then the part heals back to almost normal function. Okay, so that's sort of where the concept of steroid use in joints came about.
So plainly speaking, for a long time, steroids have worked.
They've always worked.
Okay.
Right. So steroids have always worked. Mm. It's just that now we're sort of trying to be a little bit more granular and say, well, in which circumstances do steroids work best? Mm. In which circumstances are steroid appropriate? In which circumstances are steroid less appropriate? And that basically is sort of tailored medicine. So for every single individual, you have to make a decision. Is this the right thing? Is this not the right thing?
Okay, so let's look at that a little bit more. Let's look at it in the context of osteoarthritis, simply because the study did mention that condition. Actually, I'm quite aware of your views on diagnosing osteoarthritis just via imaging alone. I'm happy to revisit this. You've talked a lot about you need to know when it is that the steroid treatment is appropriate.
Yes.
So in the case of osteoarthritis, how do you know that it's appropriate?
Okay. You know it's appropriate when the pain is principally inflammatory in the joint.
And you know that how?
Usually with the patient's symptoms.
Okay.
So the patient will say that they have, say for example, pain at rest. Pain at rest doesn't happen when bones rub on bones, right? with startup stiffness. So they say, you know, I have a lot of difficulty standing up or starting the movement. Then I'm sort of better when I warm up kind of thing. Mm. Or first thing in the morning, it's really stiff and it hurts, right? So those are all sort of indicators of inflammation. Mm. You know, I have a passion for ultrasound of the musculoskeletal system. Mm-hmm. So for me, my objective answer always comes from the ultrasound.
Right.
What structure is inflamed? How much inflammation is there? You know, is there fluid associated with it? Are there complications of the inflammation? Mm-hmm. So, but that's probably not a fair, bar. That's just my peculiar interest. The fair bar would be what is the nature of the problem? Mm. Now, here's where it gets pretty interesting. The steroids, actually, if you look back at the so far, we've only talked about the chemical properties or the sort of biological properties of steroid, mm-hmm. right? We haven't talked about the chemical properties of steroid. Now, one of the very strong chemical properties of steroid is collagenolysis. So that means it actually melts away tissue.
Okay.
So one of the uses of steroids in skin diseases is in dermatology, is where somebody has a very thick and ugly scar called a keloid. Mm-hmm. They will actually inject steroid into the scar. And the scar will fade away. Scar will melt and become not thick anymore.
Mm.
And that's because steroids have a particular chemical characteristic of melting collagen bonds. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very careful where you put them.
Mm.
In the old days, before commercial glues were available, glue that you would use to sort of glue leather or paper, for example, was made by boiling horse bones and skin.
I remember, not that I was around at that point in time, but I certainly remember the history.
Yep, so that's the history. So now what happens is, if you take a pot of glue, if you take a pot of animal glue and you put a drop of steroid into it, the glue dissolves into water.
Ah,
right?
Fascinating.
So the chemical property of corticosteroids is that they break down collagen bonds.
Mm.
And that's one of the issues with the use of corticosteroids. If a corticosteroid is given and the steroid ends up in the wrong place, you end up weakening tissues.
Okay.
Right? So, and I think that's probably the basis of what's going on in that paper. Because in the paper, they basically took 400-something people and they said, well, let's look at all of these people. We give them steroid injections. How many of them had a complication? About 8% had a complication.
Mm.
All right. So the question is, why did they have a complication?
Mm.
So let's follow through the logic.
And we will do that as soon as we take a short break, if you don't mind. I'm speaking to consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh about the efficacy of steroid injections for hip and knee pain. If you have any questions on this topic, please do feel free to tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or you can call in for a chat at 0377-332-900. As I mentioned, we're going to take a short break now, but please do stick around for the next part of our discussion on health and living for the bigger picture. This is BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. I'm Sumitra Selvaraj, and with me is consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh. Today we're talking about steroid jabs for knee and hip pain associated with osteoarthritis. And the reason why we're exploring this topic is because of a recent study published in the journal Radiology, which suggests that there is a need to have a little bit of caution in delivering these steroid injections for patients. So if you have any questions for us on this topic, if you've had a steroid jab and you'd like to find out a little bit more information, please do feel free to tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or you can call in at 0377-332-900. Dr. Rajesh, before the break, we were talking about, well, you started going into what the study looked like. Perhaps you can recap that for us.
Okay, so let's look at this. You have 400-odd patients, all of whom had a steroid injection.
Okay.
And the fact that it's in the Journal of Radiology suggests that the study, the injections were given by non-orthopedic surgeons. They were given by other people.
Mm-hmm.
Then 8% of those had a complication. Okay, mm-hmm. So let's look at why the complications may have happened.
Mm-hmm.
So possibility number one is the fact that the patient is going to have the complication anyway.
And, fair enough.
Right, and all the steroid did was it reduced the pain on the way to the complication.
Mm-hmm.
Possibility number two is that all of those patients were not going to have a complication. And as a result of the medication, 8% of them had a complication.
Mm-hmm.
That's possibility number two. And possibility number three is that the technique of the injection itself caused the harm and not the steroid.
All right.
Okay, so that's probably the three ways I'd look at it.
Mm.
Now, I think the first reason is probably the most likely in this scenario.
Mm.
Because I've explained at the start of the show that inflammation is the final common pathway and inflammation is present in painful arthritic diseases.
Mm.
So the patient has a flare of inflammation on their way to another event, for example, acute rapid chondrolysis, also avascular necrosis. So that means that you can have a heart attack, you can have a stroke. In the same way, you can have a bone attack where the blood supply to the bone is obstructed and then the bone's going to die. So when you have a bone attack, you have an insult, you can't see that result straight away. But what you can see is you can see inflammation. So then you get a steroid injection and then they have avascular necrosis, and the avascular necrosis is wrongly ascribed to the steroid injection because there's another layer of confusion. One of the potential side effects of high-dose intravenous use of corticosteroids is bone death.
Oh.
Right. So that's where the confusion comes. Because if you give, so in the old days before we knew about sort of the effects of steroids or the sort of potentially harmful effects of steroids, people were given very high doses of steroids for medical and surgical conditions because there wasn't really very much other effective treatment. And in those people, in some of them, their bone died. So, but that doesn't happen usually when you inject a low dose into a joint.
Can I go back to something that you mentioned earlier on in the first segment about how a property of steroids is the fact that it does cause collagen to dissolve.
Yes.
And I just want to quote something from the study. The lead researcher, Ali Ghermazi, and his colleagues described that some of the patients, in the worst case, had, quote, rapid joint destruction.
Correct.
Sounds a little bit like collagen dissolving.
So it does. So, but the problem is that acute rapid chondrolysis is an entity seen by itself. Okay, so we come down to that sort of final common pathway again. So you've got 400 people rushing through the gate. Some of those are wearing blue sweaters. They're going to get past the gate anyway, right? So that having been said, the steroid that you do inject can cause acute rapid chondrolysis depending on, firstly, if you inject the steroid wrongly. So if the steroid's injected and causes damage to the cartilage, that in itself can cause acute rapid chondrolysis.
Okay,
so the mechanical act of puncturing cartilage, be it on a femoral head in particular, can cause acute rapid chondrolysis. And the analogy for that is because if you look at the development or the tension on cartilage on the femoral head, it's like taking a golf ball and then wrapping it in a glove or a stocking.
Okay.
Right? So you've got this sort of golf ball that's got this rubber stretched around it. And that's the tension within the cartilage of the femoral head. Now, if you go and you prick the sort of the rubber on the ball in the wrong place, the rubber's just going to peel away. Okay? So that's how acute rapid chondrolysis by puncture occurs.
So to the patient or to the layperson, would that then feel or look like the speeding up of symptoms?
Entirely.
Right.
Entirely, right? So that's why the public needs to understand that the question of whether you get steroids or not does it does bear some discussion. But it's sort of, there's a degree of commonality in terms of what to expect when a medical procedure is done.
Could we look at risk factors, perhaps?
No identified risk factors. So we know that patients who are diabetic, for example, they tend to do a little bit more poorly with steroid injections. We think it's because it causes a response where their blood sugars tend to go up. And then when blood sugars go up, healing's a little bit poor. Blood sugars go up, you have a slightly increased risk of infection. You know, this, it's not as black and white as the paper tries to make it out to be. You know, sort of this infinite shades of gray. And for every individual patient, the treatment has to be tailored. So I'll give you an example. I saw a very attractive lady. She's a model, and she had pain in the wrist. And the diagnosis was she had inflammation of one of the wrist tendons. And she's very, very dark-skinned, right? And her career was as a model. One of the complications of giving her a steroid injection into the tendon is it may cause the melanin pigments that give her skin the dark color to go away.
Oh.
Because of the effect of melting collagen bonds. Okay, so the color of the skin is contained in little sacs or packets, and the sacs or packets contain a pigment called melanin. And what the steroid does in this circumstance, it has an affinity to break those bonds. And so you get deep pigmentation. So you may have heard of a condition called vitiligo.
Yes.
Where people have patches of white skin.
Very famously, Michael Jackson.
Very famously, Michael Jackson. And now there's some model who's sort of the, what's the word? The affirmative body shape.
Move. Yes, body positive movement.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yep. So there's, I can't remember her name, but I did see it in a magazine recently.
Yes. We're all about diversity.
That's the one.
Even on catwalks.
Okay, even on catwalks. So the problem with this young lady was her treatment choices were either surgery, which would be done under general anesthetic and for me to cut the skin, or an injection, which would be a steroid injection.
Okay.
Guess which one she chose?
Yeah, I'm guessing nothing that was going to harm her career.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So she said, a scar I can cover with makeup. A big patch of deep pigmentation I can't.
Right.
So, you know, it almost seemed like a no-brainer to give a steroid injection because you go, you know, why would anyone reasonably choose a general anesthetic cut to the skin, stitches, removal of stitches and scar over a simple injection? But the treatment has to be tailored to what is it that's important to that person at that time.
So does the choice come down to them then rather than your prescribed recommendation?
Okay. So I have a reasonably sort of simple view to this. My job as a doctor is to identify the problem to the best of my ability, explain it in terms which are understandable to the patient, and then to give them treatment options.
Right.
Including the do-nothing treatment option all the way to the most aggressive treatment option. And from that, the patient has to have the responsibility to choose. So it's sort of more a shared model of decision-making because they haven't had, you know, the advantage of 15 years of schooling to be able to make that decision. But I haven't had the advantage of their individual life and circumstances to know what is correct and appropriate for them. So they have to make the decision. My job is to be able to lay out the options in a way which are reasonable. And also based on my experience, like as soon as this model walked in, I went and complained, I already had decided, no way am I going to give a steroid injection.
Okay. Right? So I wouldn't be doing my job unless I asked you, have you seen steroid injections go terribly wrong?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When I was in university practice, we used to get them from a different department where the steroids were routinely given by non-orthopedic surgeons, perhaps a lot like where that paper was published from.
Right.
And so when there were complications, those doctors weren't in a position to deal with them. And because they weren't in a position to deal with them, then we sort of inherited it. So, look, I'm a surgeon and I'm biased in that way. But my view is, if you're going to start something, be ready to finish it. If you're going to start something and you're not able or ready to finish it, have somebody who is able and ready to finish it with you or for you. But don't sort of do stuff and then, you know, dump patients. I think that's completely unreasonable.
How common would you say are steroid injections when it comes to the treatment of osteoarthritis?
Oh, hundreds and thousands done every day in this country is standard treatment.
And hundreds and thousands, would you call that overprescribed?
No. Well, let's look at it this way. So a patient has a painful joint and they've tried, say for example, rest, use of a stick, use of ice packs, and they've taken some anti-inflammatory medication. They say, when I take the anti-inflammatory medication, the pain goes away. Okay? I stop the anti-inflammatory medication, in 2 or 3 days, the pain comes back. So, and we've got no identifiable, reversible factor for that inflammation. Okay? Then what do you do? If you leave the joint inflamed, the joint eventually gets destroyed because fires cook things. You leave the fire long enough, the joint gets destroyed. You give the patient non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications by mouth long enough, you poison their kidney, give them strokes and heart attacks. So what do? Exactly right. So it becomes an issue of trying to work out what the most appropriate treatment is in this particular circumstance.
Is there any merit to the placebo effect? There was a 2017 JAMA study saying that there was really no difference between patients who received steroid injections versus saline injections.
On pain, no. But on inflammation, yes. So that's why I like the ultrasound again. Doesn't lie. It's 100%, well, I suppose as close, practically as 100% as you can get, sensitive for inflammation and fluid. So I try to be as objective as I can. Now, pain is certainly a relevant measure.
Right.
But inflammation to me is more an objective marker of what should happen. So give you another simple case. So you saw a 19-year-old girl who had a right index finger pain and swelling for a couple of years. And she said that every time she sort of has got exams or lots of writing to do, the joint becomes painful and swollen.
Mm.
So, you know, went to see GP. GP said, oh, it's probably just exam stress. You know, have some rest, have some anti-inflammatories, pain will go away. So when I saw her, her father brought her because he said, oh, you know, it's a Monday. She's got an exam on Thursday. Quick, doc, do something. So I examined her and I said, look, you've probably got rheumatoid arthritis. It's an autoimmune disorder. And this autoimmune disorder is attacking this joint.
Mm.
He says, but why only pain during exam time? I said, well, there's a small fire. When you write a lot, it's like a fan.
Mm.
When you fan a small fire, fire becomes big. And you fan a lot near exam time. So then the hand gets painful, angry.
And is that enough to justify or require a steroid jab, in your opinion?
Well, so this is the question. So the question was, what do we do for this young lady?
Mm.
Right? So let's look at the risks and the benefits
Please.
For her. Okay. So her problem is she can't write exams very well. It's Monday and the exam's on Thursday.
Mm.
So what are the choices on the table? Choice number one is for me to give her a steroid injection into the joint. Pros, pain goes away within 24 hours. Cons, potential for thinning of the skin, potential for weakening of the tendon based on the direction I have to put it in.
Can I just ask, does the pain go away in 24 hours with just the one jab?
Yes.
Okay.
That's because you have a fire. I pour water, no more fire.
Okay.
Tomorrow somebody go and pour petrol and put fire again, different story. Okay. So that's one option. The other option is to write her a letter for her exam saying that she's got a painful finger and she needs a little bit more time to write.
Mm.
Okay. Because that was the problem. So, and also give her a short course of anti-inflammatory medication and an ice pack, which is basically what I did in that circumstance. And I referred her to a rheumatologist. I said, there's no point me putting out this fire because it's just going to come again.
Mm.
So you need to see the person who controls why your body's poking fire.
Mm.
Right? And so when that referral comes through, if the rheumatologist says, okay, Rajesh, you know, I've sorted out all these reasons why she should have a fire in there, but I still can't put the fire out, or there's been a complication of the inflammation, then that's stuff I'm very happy to deal with.
Right. And do you feel that at this point where you have laid all the options out on the table for your patients, that they are aware of the repercussions or complications that may or may not come with
They've usually already decided that before they've walked in, right? Because they've spoken to Dr. Google and or relatives.
Google's our favorite.
Dr. Google's our favorite, exactly right. So a lot of the time, what they want to know is something bad going to happen?
Yes.
Right? Because the public doesn't know.
Mm.
So one of the things my patients hear most from me is, you know, cannot die, cannot paralyze, nothing bad can happen. Because they don't know that. Right? They literally don't know that cannot die, cannot paralyze, nothing bad can happen.
Mm.
Once they know that, then they go, okay, well, if that's the case, then what are my treatment options?
Yeah.
Right? Mm. So it's very simple. I had this gentleman this afternoon who complained of calf pain.
Okay.
When he walks. So I examined him and I said, well, you know, your pain's not coming from the skeletal system. It's coming from the vascular system.
Mm-hmm.
There's not enough blood going to the muscles. So when you walk fast or you walk up slopes, the muscle has this thing called claudication.
Mm-hmm.
And when I said that, the wife looked like she was in a panic because I'd said to her that there's not enough blood supply to the leg. So what does that mean? Leg going to drop off. Right? So easy to laugh, but you know, it's from their perspective,
sure.
Leg's going to drop off. So I said, well, the leg's not going to drop off because there's obviously enough blood supply to keep the leg going, except when you walk up hills or you walk quickly up a slope.
Mm.
So, you know, you can enjoy the holiday period, but you need to see a vascular surgeon. And I gave them a referral to a vascular surgeon. Mm. I said, if you're really worried about it, you can see them sooner. If you're less worried about it, you can see them in the new year.
See, I know this is a topic that you're particularly passionate about. I mean, you've talked about looking at the cause of the pain.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at the cause of what's causing the discomfort or the inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're saying, you know, do a proper clinical diagnosis. Don't just rely on the imaging. Mm-hmm. Does everybody have the luxury of time to do that?
Okay. In governments, actually, let's put it this way. Consider the cost of not doing it.
Mm.
All right. So I will go head to head with you on that statement.
Mm.
The logic doesn't require time.
Mm.
Imaging requires time. Good clinical acumen developed over years is instantaneous, right? So it's the development of that good clinical acumen that takes the time. So my mom's a pediatrician And in the old days, before CT scans and MRIs and ultrasounds, the tools which she had were her ears and her hands and her eyes. So she would look, she would feel, she would palpate, and she would re-examine. So that was one of the things I learned even before I started med school. The value of re-examination.
Right.
Because without an investigation, you are looking for change. And that's really what you're interested in. An image is just a snapshot in time. It is not truth. But patients come to me with MRI saying, oh, you know, my disc is slipped or my meniscus is torn or whatever it was. That's that snapshot at that point in time. It's not a reflection of reality.
And it's not enough to use to dispense steroid jabs, perhaps willy-nilly.
No, it's not enough to be a subject of BAF. That's brainless application of radiological findings, right? So sticking a steroid into a joint on the basis of an MRI alone without a sophisticated synthesis is BAF. And BAF is not good.
It isn't good. But what is good at this point is another break. I'm speaking to consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh about the efficacy of steroid injections for hip and knee pain. If you have any more questions on this topic, we've got about 15 minutes or so. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 01878988899. Or you can call in at 03773329900. This is Health and Living for the Bigger Picture. This is BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. I'm Sumitra Selvarajan. With me is consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh. Today, we're talking about steroid jabs for knee and hip pain associated with osteoarthritis and whether there could be any potential side effects to the treatment. Dr. Rajesh says yay or nay?
Yes, of course. There are potential side effects to any treatment. You just have to consider what they are in your particular individual patient and whether the risks outweigh the benefits.
Okay, so speaking of treatments, especially with regards to osteoarthritis, perhaps we can go into some other treatment options for hip and knee pain?
Yep. What would you like?
Well, why don't we start with stem cells?
Okay. The problem with stem cells is like saying tea.
Tea?
Tea. So,
chai?
No, tea. Chai, yes.
Yes.
Okay. So steroids are Coca-Cola.
Okay.
Which is manufactured in factories according to a standard process everywhere in the world. It's put into cans and bottles, sold and marketed quite efficiently. So it's very easy to price Coca-Cola. And it's very easy to compare Coke and Pepsi. Okay. The problem with all biologic treatments, it's like tea. So tea in my house, not the same as tea in your house.
No.
Not same as the tea in the tea shop. Not the same as the tea in the tea shop in India. Not same as the tea in the tea shop in Bangsa. Chinese tea, not the same as Thai tea. Thai tea, not the same as English breakfast tea.
Yes.
And therein is the problem when you talk about, when you say stem cells, I'll take all regenerative treatments. Okay. All regenerative treatments involve the process of making tea. So that's the real problem when you want to talk about regenerative treatments. And then you have to talk about, well, you know, lady says, I like tea. She meant Chinese tea.
Right.
You give her English breakfast. She goes, this rubbish tea. And that's the problem that we have when you talk about regenerative treatments. Coca-Cola, everybody knows what Coca-Cola is. Okay. So the idea of regenerative treatments is excellent, but I think they're completely misdirected because all regenerative treatments only ever talk about cartilage.
And perhaps you could just outline for us what other types of regenerative treatments we could lump into this tea.
Tea,
cozy,
okay.
Yes.
So when you talk about stem cells, there's sort of different types of cells. So you can get fat cells, blood cells, cells from babies, cells from umbilical cords, cells from yourself. You can get different types of cells. You know, all the sort of different types of tea leaves. You go to a tea shop, you know, it's mind-boggling. It's hundreds of teas available. So similarly with stem cell treatments, there are hundreds of different types of cells that you can use. Okay, then into the mix, you throw biologics like the factors involved, right? Which would be like the interleukins, cytokines, which are commonly distilled out of this thing called PRP or platelet-rich plasma. Okay, so that's like in the brewing process, you know, whether you use hot water, cold water, exactly what temperature it is, how long you boil it for, all of those things. So it makes a difference to the flavor of your tea. What type of water you use makes a difference to the flavor of your tea as well. Okay, so that's why I call them regenerative treatments, because it's all in that big basket. I think that the whole world is confused because they're only talking about cartilage.
What should we be talking about?
The whole joint. Uh-huh. So what constitutes a joint? So simple, you know, second year medical student anatomy that I teach. Mm-hmm. What is a joint? A joint is a place where two bones meet and articulate. Mm. What are the components of the joint? The components of the joint are, well, obviously the ends of the bones, which have specializations to enable them to accommodate the pressure. Mm. They have a covering of cartilage. They have a lining of synovium, which lubricates the joint and sort of does care for the joint. It has a capsule, which is a fibrous layer that binds the two bones together. Mm-hmm. There are the ligaments, which give stability to the joints in particular actions. Then there are tendons, which muscles adhere to cross the joint to create movement across the joint.
Surely there cannot be one treatment to address various aspects of the joint.
Exactly my point. Exactly my point. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say the world is confused. Mm-hmm. When you talk about arthritis, mm-hmm. you say the cartilage is damaged. Well, what about everything else? Mm-hmm. Now, we know from basic science studies that the pain doesn't come from cartilage. Cartilage has no nerves in it.
Right.
The pain comes from the subchondral bone, which is the bone plate on which the cartilage rests. Mm-hmm. So we know that anti-osteoporosis treatment, which strengthens bone, reduces the pain of osteoarthritis, the true bone ache of osteoarthritis. Mm. And well, that's kind of pretty straightforward because the joint's got, you know, five or six components. The more of those components you address, the better your result.
Sure.
Seems pretty straightforward, doesn't it?
You would think.
Common sense is the most uncommon of senses.
Okay. Let's move on from the treatment options, of which they are many and varied, as types of tea, to lifestyle modifications to address this idea of hip and knee pain.
Okay, so lifestyle modifications are pretty key, right? So the whole process of making tea doesn't really matter if you don't live in a tea drinking culture, if you live in a coffee drinking culture. Mm. Okay, so the components of the joint, all those components of the joint which I described, all follow basic laws of the skeleton, which is the fact that if you use it, it changes. If you use it appropriately, it changes correctly and appropriately. If you use it too much, then it can cause damage. If you don't rest it, then the damage accumulates and causes other problems. Mm. So it's sort of, it behoves us to understand the skeletal system in terms of what does it do and how it responds. And the simple sort of analogy is of a rubber band. So the skeletal system is like rubber. So you can have rubber in a car tire, that's rubber, right? But that's really strong and hard. You can have rubber in the sort of pencil eraser rubber. Mm-hmm. That's got a different characteristics. You can have rubber as in like the sort of rubber band that your newspaper comes wrapped in. Mm-hmm. That's a different kind of characteristic again. So, but all components of the skeletal system basically behave like rubber. So if you have a piece of rubber that you leave in your car, you know, a rubber band that you leave in your car in the hot sun for days on end, and then you pick it up, it just crumbles in your hand, right? But if you have a rubber band that you've been using regularly in the office for something, you sort of keep using it again and again and again, the rubber band can last quite a long time, but it may eventually snap, and it usually snaps when you sort of pull it too hard when you're trying to wrap something. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's basically what the skeletal system is like.
Or over time, it might lose its tensile strength.
Exactly right. Mm. So it gets a little bit less rubbery.
Right.
So it's still, the tensile strength is still the same, but the rubberiness decreases. Mm. And then when you stretch it, it can't bounce back, and then it snaps. Mm. Right. So it's sort of, I think if you want to sort of have a mental picture of the elements of the skeletal system and how you deal with them, you basically deal with them like rubber bands. Mm.
Okay. We're running out of time, but I want to bring this back to right to the beginning of our conversation when we talked a little bit about the study that was presented and how, you know, media headlines have picked up the study and are cautioning us that these steroid injections are perhaps more dangerous than we previously thought they were. Your thoughts on this rather delightfully clickbaity headlines?
understand where the clickbait came from, right? It's like everyone saying Coca-Cola is the best drink in the whole world, and then somebody coming around and saying, well, you know, maybe Coca-Cola not so good for you, right? But it starts from the fact that everybody's drinking Coca-Cola. And that's, I think, where the sort of context of this headline should be, that steroids are absolutely wonderful, amazing drugs, but they do bear some thinking about.
And thank you for helping us think those things through. I think it's time for a cup of tea.
It is.
Okay, that's all the time that we have for today's show. I've been speaking to consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh about how steroid injections for hip and knee pain associated with osteoarthritis may be harmful in certain groups of patients or may cause complications that are not well understood. But it is your job as patients to do the due diligence to try and understand it, aided of course by your friendly consultant orthopedic surgeon. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Health and Living segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.